what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. This is your weekly wildfire update. Thanks for everybody for tuning in. Thanks again to all the subscribers of the Substack. None of this would be possible without you. I appreciate all of your support. I'm 100% ad-free and sponsorship-free, and everything I do is supported through the community. So thank you to the individuals who participate in that and allow me to do what I do here. If you want to support the show and everything else that I do, donations to the community, giveaways, and have access to all the archives and articles, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com and click on that subscribe button. On today's show, we have a couple pretty incredible topics that we are going to talk about. First and foremost, we're going to talk about this investigation out of Idaho that happened up in Salmon, Idaho, where the Department of Justice put out a report saying that there were individuals and wildland fire contractors in Idaho who were bid rigging contracts for fuel tenders and all sorts of other things. They were collaborating together, two different companies, to run everybody out of that business and basically form a monopoly to get these bids to go on wildland fires and make money. And once they ran everybody out, their whole goal was to then jack prices up and make a ton of money after they've destroyed their competition. The East Idaho News put out a report on this. It's been all over the Idaho News as well. And when it comes to the wildfire world, contractors and ICP and everyone who's involved in these Viper contracts with the government to aid and assist and ultimately have a business in this wildfire industry, a lot of folks are paying attention to this. They ended up wiretapping these guys, and it became this massive investigation. They said that this bid rigging and the attempt to make a monopoly out of these fire contracts had been going on for years and years and years, and it got to the point to where finally the Department of Justice got involved. It became a very intensive investigation to where they finally caught these guys. So we'll cover that. I also want to make it known that even though these people have been indicted for this bid rigging, they still have an upcoming trial and these charges are still alleged. Also, we're going to talk about this article in Outside Magazine. It was written by a Lewis and Clark hotshot, if I remember correctly, and it covers other hotshots who are involved in ultramarathons and basically these endurance athlete events. And they talk about their experience with that, how being a hotshot helps with that. And we've talked about this before. I had on Fred, who is the superintendent of the Helena Hotshots. He is an ultramarathoner. We talked about that at length. If you want to find that podcast, you can, both on the Substack and Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And we talk about these endurance athletes. And one of the people that they cover, actually, Danny Goodson, was the winner of one of our boot giveaways. And it was nice to see this coverage and the spotlight shone on these individuals who really are high-level endurance athletes, and thank them for sharing these experiences that they've had. On that note, we are doing another boot giveaway here soon. If you want to participate in that, if you are a paid subscriber to the Substack, you are automatically entered in to win that pair of boots. So look for that coming up soon here as well. We'll dive into what was going on up in Idaho. It's actually kind of a really big deal. As I said, this was an extensive investigation that went into trying to catch these folks. And the main article out of East Idaho News, entitled "Two Business Owners Accused of Rigging Bids for Wildland Firefighting Equipment." For folks who are in the wildfire world, it's known that you show up to ICP or the Incident Command Post, and there is a plethora of contractors there. You have folks who are contracted to weed wash, contractors for food. You have contractors for different types of equipment. You might even bring in third-party contractors for chainsaw repair, things like that. And then, of course, you have the fuel tenders, the folks bringing in the water trucks, the garbage folks, And it's all run through these federal contracting systems known as Viper contracts. It is on a bid basis, and these folks were taking advantage by colluding with each other to run everybody else out, and then they could have control of those contracts in a monopoly-style fashion and jack up the price. It says two executives were indicted last week for allegedly defrauding the United States Forest Service and other federal and state agencies over truck contracts for fighting wildfires. Ike Tomlinson, 60, of Tarrant, and Chris Byrd of Salmon, Idaho, 61, were each indicted by a grand jury on one count of felony conspiracy to commit wire fraud, five counts of felony wire fraud, one count of conspiracy and restraint of trade, bid rigging, and territorial allocation. That last one, territorial allocation, they were coordinating with each other where they were going to send trucks, where they were going to pull trucks out of, and they were coordinating moving these trucks around certain areas, even though they were, quote, competitors of each other, and kind of aligning their businesses so they could take advantage of these contracts. It says Tomlinson and Byrd, who own competing companies, conspired to rig bids and allocate territories, like straight up mobster style stuff, violating the Sherman Act, according to the news release from the United States Attorney District's Office of Idaho. The Federal Trade Commission says the Sherman Act of 1890 outlaws every contract, combination, or conspiracy and restraint of trade, and any monopolization attempt or conspiracy to combine or combination to monopolize. The indictment says that to secure the best deal for taxpayers and promote free and fair competition, the U.S. Forest Service advertises and runs a bidding process to award certain firefighting-related contracts to qualified small businesses. These vendors supply fuel trucks, water trucks, communication trailers, and more. Contractors basically run the Incident Command Post, also known as ICP. The Forest Service awards contracts to vendors based on service they provide in a location at a price determined during these bidding processes. Then, when wildfires occur, state and federal agencies will rely on those contracts to order and dispatch equipment on short notice. Now, I've covered a lot of the catering contracts because those changed drastically in the last couple years, where previously it was closest contractor responds. But then these contracts were recently changed to cheapest goes first. And then ultimately what you have is people low bidding each other to try to become the cheapest to then be dispatched to these wildfires to provide food services. And ultimately that runs down the quality of food that we end up feeding our firefighters out on these incidents. So I've talked about certain contracts a lot, but this one kind of came as a surprise. Actually, not really a surprise. You know, I've talked to a lot of firefighters and some contractors, and they're like, hey, there's a lot of shady stuff going on. To be honest, I'm going to do a podcast on this later on once I dig up a little bit more information. But there's a lot of medical folks who have reached out to me, and they're like, you should look into the medical contracting side of wildland fire. The last 3-4 years, there's been a lot of shady stuff going on. There's been a lot of backdoor deals, and that's actually becoming an issue as well. And a fair amount of people in that medical contracting world, where you have these line medics, EMTs, and other companies coming in to provide these services, there's a lot of folks out there that are agitated and a little pissed off that it's not, you know, they don't think it's being done fairly. And I've looked into a little bit of it, and it does seem to hold some water with these people talking about it. So I'm trying to put something together for that as well. But this sort of thing does happen. It says the indictment stated that the U.S. Forest Service expects vendors' bids to be competitive and confidential. And that's the big thing, is you're not supposed to talk about your bids to other companies, because then you can do these certain things. You can rig the bids to try to win these contracts. Continuing, it says, stating that companies compete with each other to have the lowest price bid and to be higher on that dispatch priority list. According to the felony indictment, Tomlinson and Byrd worked together to affect the contracts for forest firefighting services to make the most money possible. The indictment alleges that from at least or about around February of 2014 up until March of 2023, so basically a decade they were doing this, Tomlinson and Byrd coordinated their bids to, quote, squeeze or drown out their competitors, accepted payment for fuel trucks at collusive and non-competitive daily rates, and tried to conceal their actions. The investigation was conducted by the department's Procurement Collusion Strike Force, known as PCSF, which included the FBI, with judicial authorization, intercepting phone calls between the two individuals. As alleged, Tomlinson and Byrd spoke with one another shortly before the deadline to submit these wildfire bids on fuel truck contracts. During calls quoted in the indictment, they allegedly agreed to rig their bids, allocate certain territorial locations, and target their competitors. Super shady stuff, folks. The indictment quotes a text conversation between Tomlinson and Byrd where the two are discussing raising the prices for water tenders, also known as water tankers, essential firefighting equipment used to transport water from a water source to a fire. And water tenders are very, very important on a wildfire. Not only can they provide drinking water and water used in ICP for showering and for the food unit, things like that, water tenders also do dust mitigation at both camp and helibase, at the airports, at helispots, and provide water for engines, blivets, things like this. It's an essential piece of equipment, and these folks were rigging bids and trying to drive competition out when it came to these types of equipment. In these text messages, it was quoted as first Tomlinson saying, quote, got my water tenders in, did not put any in salmon, FYI. Byrd then responded, you are the man, exclamation point. If you want to put a couple here for a high amount, I don't really care. Tomlinson, I think I might do that. What should I bid? Byrd, I'll find out what my bid was, and then maybe we'll both raise them up, and then added a laughing emoji. Tomlinson, okay, sounds good. Just let me know. So pretty blatant fraud. It says the indictment also states that in 2020, Tomlinson admitted to his ongoing collusion with Byrd in a recorded conversation, suggesting to an unnamed individual that if they did not work together, the individuals would make no money. The indictment quotes the conversation where Tomlinson told the person, quote, as far as the fuel trucks go, I mean, it's just like, you know how Chris Byrd and I work together? We basically talk once or twice a year and decide what we're going to do, and we work it all out. Now, if I wasn't honest and didn't work it out with you guys that year, trust is gone and we're done. You know what I mean? We're back to battling, but if we're back to battling when we're both back to making no money, you see what I'm saying? So there's even like idle threats in those conversations. Tomlinson then suggested the individual could, quote, buy all the trailers, and himself and Byrd would, quote, do the fuel trucks, allowing them to have an agreement where we don't compete against each other. The indictment says the other person told Tomlinson that his collusion with Byrd was illegal, but the two continued on anyway. Through a wiretap on Tomlinson's cell phone, investigators heard Tomlinson and Byrd discussing how to push other potential contractors out of the bidding process, with Byrd allegedly saying, quote, we could punch them suckers down so hard it hurts them. So they were trying to destroy other people's livelihoods by doing mobster-type activity when it came to these Viper contracts. Super shady stuff. According to the release, a violation of the Sherman Act carries a maximum penalty of 10 years in federal prison, a $1 million fine for individuals, and a maximum penalty of $100 million for corporations. So it's a big deal. The maximum fine may be increased to twice the gain derived from the crime or twice the loss suffered by victims if either amount is greater than the maximum. And this took place over 10 years. I'm sure millions of dollars a year were potentially on the line for these contracts, so this could add up to quite a bit. A violation of the wire fraud statute carries a maximum penalty of 20 years in federal prison. A federal district court judge will determine any sentence after considering the U.S. sentencing guidelines and other statutory factors. The Antitrust Division's San Francisco office, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Idaho, and FBI Salt Lake Field Office, including the Boise Resident Agency, are all investigating this case. In November 2019, the Justice Department created the PCSF, a joint law enforcement effort to combat antitrust crimes and related fraudulent schemes that impact government procurement, grant and program funding at all levels of government, federal, state, and local. Anyone with information in connection with this investigation is asked to contact them. An indictment is merely an allegation. All defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in the court of law. So it sounds like these folks are going to see a courtroom and they will plead their case. From what the DOJ is saying out of Idaho, they have, it seems like, a lot of text conversations, a lot of phone calls, and it also sounds like numerous unnamed witnesses who are either going to testify or maybe willing to testify against these individuals. And they have a lot working against them. So we'll see where this goes in the future, but it is a very big deal. And in communities where there's a lot of folks working in the contract world, like Idaho, Utah, Montana, all these Western states, you know, there's whole communities that base their livelihoods off of wildfire. And quite frankly, if you find out that people in your community are, you know, allegedly bid rigging and things like this, that's probably going to make a lot of people upset and you're not going to be very popular in your community anymore. As I said, this was a big deal out in Idaho. A lot of folks in the wildfire world are talking about it out there. And we'll just have to see where it goes from here. Before we jump into Hot Shots and the Ultra Marathons, some people asked me to cover the government shutdown and what's going on with the funding. I covered it on Wednesday's show, if you want to check that out on the Substack, but I'll just quickly, you know, get back at it for folks who didn't hear that. Basically, they passed a continuing resolution to keep funding going through the first week of March. I believe there's two different shutdown dates now. It might be March 2nd and March 9th. Don't quote me on that, but it's right in that area. And we'll basically have to go through this whole funding conversation again at that point in time. When it comes to the Bureau of Land Management, firefighters working for them, and firefighters working for the Forest Service, funding for that supplemental payment will continue as long as the funding continues. And Deputy Director Jaylith Hall Rivera put out a statement saying, hey, there's not certain verbiage in this legislation that says we're going to give firefighters a pay raise, but the current supplemental pay increase or that retention pay will continue to be paid as long as Congress continues to fund the government. So if I had to guess, that will continue through the 2024 fire season. But as always, we have this little hiccup coming in March where we'll have to see what Congress ends up doing. Again, I'd like to thank all the paid subscribers on Substack. Couldn't do any of this without you. All the updates, the giveaways, the donations, the articles, everything wouldn't be possible without you. If you want to participate in that and support the show, support the community, and support what I'm doing here at the Hotshot Wake Up, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that subscribe button, and that supports everything that I do.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
So I've discussed on the show many times the arduous environment that hotshots work and live in, the athletic ability that you have to be on one of these crews and to sustain yourself through long durations of arduous work and have the stamina to do so. That's why I always say cardio is king. People ask me all the time, hey, what should I do to learn how to be on a hotshot crew? Well, it's you should hike with weight on your back and you should get your cardio dialed. Obviously, there should be some weight training there as well just to build some sort of muscle mass. But you don't have to be this huge 6'6" jacked individual to be a hotshot. You have to be an endurance athlete who's able to go for hours and hours and hours on end for days on end as well. And then you just repeat that for 7 months straight. As I said at the top of the show, I've interviewed multiple individuals on the show who have talked about this, and they do ultra marathons running 50, 60, 70 miles at a time. They do this in their off time, in the off season. And I have even had people on my crew who ran ultras after a fire roll. And we all thought that these folks were crazy, but that's what they do, and they enjoy it, and it's a massive challenge to do something like that. And Outside Magazine put out an article by Craig Maynard, who is with the Lewis and Clark Hotshots. It's a well-written article, and it's talking about hotshots in the industry who run these ultramarathons. It's entitled, Hotshot Firefighters Are Coming for Ultramarathoners, which I love. And it says, America's hard-bitten wildland firefighters are switching gears in the off-season to run ultra distances. It starts out saying, it's day 9. I haven't showered in over a week. In the last 9 days, I've worked 144 hours. My skin is blistered by the wind and the sun. My feet look like hammered dog shit. And my lunch's sandwich meat looks like it's been made out of an unworldly material. Yep, 100%. Five more shifts to go. 14 days of 16-hour stints, hiking up ridgetops, ascending down into drainages, then up again, then down again, with 40-plus pounds strapped to my back. Welcome to the world of hotshots. Interagency hotshot crews, known as hotshots, are akin to the A-teams of fire suppression. Our elite squads consist of 20 to 25 personnel assigned to the most dangerous, tactical, and challenging wildfires in the country. What a lot of folks don't know is when you show up to a fire and it's just rugged as hell, they say in the briefings, that's hotshot country. We're not sending anybody up there but hotshots. We're not sending anybody down there but hotshots. It's well known the capabilities of these crews, and that's why you order them when you have this type of terrain and these difficult missions. Hotshot crews are also able to break up into separate mods or squads, so you basically can have three separate units coming out of one crew to operate on your incident and operate at a very high level. Hotshot crews, when they show up to a fire, are basically a set-it-and-forget-it resource. You talk to the division or you talk to the operations sections chief, or if you're on a smaller incident, you talk to the incident commander. And they basically just give you a division, or they give you a side of the fire, or they give you a couple ridge lines and say, that's where you folks are going to go. We'll let you do your work and we'll take care of everybody else. Just check in with us once in a while and let us know how it's all going. It says, as the fire season comes to an end, firefighters begin focusing on their health and fitness. Absolutely. I've been a huge proponent of this. Get fit, stay fit. It's something that's been incredibly important in my life. And again, I try to promote this both on the Substack and all the social media that it's highly important if you want to be a high-level operator in the wildfire world or just in life in general. It takes work. You have to continuously maintain it, keep up on it, advance it, And you also have to want it. I've discussed at length also that not everybody is cut out to be on a hotshot crew. Not everybody's cut out to be a smoke jumper. These sorts of positions and jobs take a higher level of commitment. It takes a higher level of mental strength, which is a big one. You can't break under pressure. You can't break when times get tough. You have to push through. You have to constantly break down mental barriers and walls. And that only makes you stronger. And that takes a certain individual to be able to do that. It's just not any Joe or Jane off the street is able to just jump onto a hotshot crew or just can go be a smoke jumper. It says, although strength training is an important aspect of our routine, running is our bread and butter when it comes to winter. Absolutely. Cardio is king. Putting in the miles throughout the offseason, especially on trails, is proving to be the best way to maintain and improve our cardio and endurance. As an active member on a hotshot crew in Montana, I'm seeing firsthand how hotshots throughout the country are gearing up for ultra marathons. Despite working more than 1,000 hours of overtime in only 6 months, once laid off for the winter, many firefighters, like myself, are signing up and becoming contenders in ultra-distant races across the country. There's great races in Colorado. There's all sorts of awesome races in Utah, down in Moab, and places like that, running through the Red Rocks. There's even ultramarathons up in Minnesota on the Superior Hiking Trail. These things take place all over the country. It says, this line of work often attracts a particular type of person. Someone who is familiar with pushing their limits and being comfortable with discomfort for hours on end. Working long hours on rugged, wild land requires endurance, core strength, stability, and the ability to manage fatigue and mental acuity amid ever-changing environmental surroundings. Yeah, mental toughness is huge on these crews. If you're a jumper, even being a pilot for an extended period of time, wrestling with that piece of equipment, you have to be mentally fit to do these sorts of things. It says, I had the opportunity to speak to three hotshots who are pursuing ultras after the summer of wildland firefighting ended. What keeps them coming back to these challenges? Where do they find the strength to keep pushing after the fire season? And the answer to that is these are just very, very tough people. Sarah Fonda, who is 30, from Helena, Montana, is a member of the Lewis and Clark Hotshots, located in Great Falls, Montana. After her first season as a hotshot, she competed her first ultra, the Copper Corridor 50K, and has signed up for the Black Canyon 60K in February. It's fun to try to push yourself, she says, and toe that line of what I can do. To be curious about what your body can do, what your mind can put you through, and most importantly, what your mind can get you through. I'm telling you, folks, when you challenge yourself and you actually break down those mental barriers and you tear down those walls instead of stopping, giving up, and turning around, you instantly become a stronger person mentally and physically, and you can go further than you ever thought you could go before. That's what's so attractive about this type of work to individuals, is you can actually mentally and physically see yourself grow as the season goes on. It's an incredible experience. Continuing, she never thought she could get on a hotshot crew because the physical aspect was daunting. It was only after she secured a spot on the crew that Fonda discovered she could achieve things that she didn't originally think was possible. And that's when she started training for her first ultra. What keeps her coming back to both the crew and the ultras is the challenges and satisfaction that come from conquering it. On the surface, it's just good training for the upcoming season, of course, she says. But I also think it makes the transition out of fire back to real life easier because you feel like you still have a purpose. And that's huge. I speak on it all the time. You should have goals in the off season. You should have plans in the off season. You should have things to look forward to in the off season. So it's just not an off switch. And then you start wondering, you know, have I lost direction? Where do I go with my life now? Am I just waiting for the fire season to start again? And you continually challenge yourself in that off season. She says, when you give yourself a training program and maybe sign up for a race, it can be really meditative and good on your mental health to have that consistency. Spending time outside on your own terms after the season is over. 100%. One of my favorite things to do is run on rivers. It's, you know, it's a little bit harder to do when it's minus 15 degrees outside, but it's my favorite thing to do. Go get some espresso, have a little bite to eat, maybe a protein shake, drive myself to a river and throw on some tunes and just run that river until I'm exhausted. And you just never feel better. The scenery's great. Nature's out. And you just feel so good after you're all done. It says Josh Nelson, 31, from Tyron, North Carolina, was a member of the Globe Hotshots, located in Globe, Arizona, and Cherokee Hotshots in Unicoi, Tennessee. However, he recently left the crew to pursue ultra running professionally. This guy's a beast. Nelson, also a U.S. Army veteran, has competed in numerous races over the years, most recently under the sponsorship of Fleet Feet Asheville and the apparel company Zensah. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. Z-E-N-S-A-H. In fact, he ran a stunning 16 ultras in 1 year alone. This guy is crazy. Nelson explains that after working on a hotshot crew, he found he had a significant mental edge over the general public during ultras. 100%. All the hotshots that I know who have been in it for a while have a mental edge over the general population. They can just push longer. They can deal with shitty situations longer. They're able to think clearly in stressful situations and make those quality decisions when other people are panicking or just give up and run away. It's a massive advantage in your regular day-to-day life. Quote, it's easier to mentally get over the fact of running a race in the mountains when you've worked in fire, he says. It's not much an extreme thing anymore, having the ability to just be uncomfortable. It's things like that that we take for granted. Yeah, 100%. For Nelson, mental health plays a large part in why he joined a hotshot crew and why he continues to run ultras. Quote, what am I doing to make my life better? How can I make other people's lives better, he says. How can I at least feel like I'm somewhat of a role model for people? I think fire and ultra world are both pretty easy to bridge the gap and can give you a sense of purpose. I've had depression in the past. I fought a war when I was 18. Jumping into ultras is being able to push through hard things, which is the reason I think a lot of people get into fire. Both of these worlds are very similar in that way. Yeah, 100%. Next up is Danny Goodson. Again, Danny won our boot giveaway last year. She's 36, from Missoula, Montana, has spent many years as a hotshot and is currently a squad boss on Lolo Hotshots. Shout out. She has run a number of 50Ks and is currently focusing her training on efforts of the Running Up for Air series in Missoula, Montana. A lot of her motivation for training and competing throughout the winter is about keeping structure in her life and not becoming complacent, especially during a time where many people gravitate towards hibernating on the couch. It's a great point made by Danny. It's harped on a lot in the fire world, specifically on hotshot crews, jumping as well, where you fight complacency. You don't allow complacency to creep in, because that's when things slow down. That's when mistakes are made. That's when you start missing the little things. And if you start missing the little things, those add up to the point to where they become big things. Emergencies can happen. Injuries can happen. And the longer you're complacent, the longer you can end up being in a rut, or let that depression creep in, or let that doubt creep in. So it's very important, as Danny says here, to fight off that complacency. Quote, you go from hard work, structure, and camaraderie on the crew and having every minute of your life spelled out in the summer to all of a sudden being unemployed come winter. I found that once I started running ultras, I actually had this goal throughout the winter. It was just a way, especially when I lost the structure of being on the crew, to get some consistency back in my life and keep it goal-oriented. It gives me a reason to get out the door and keep doing something physical in the off-season. Yes, 100%. When you're in fire season, everything is lined out for you. When you get up, you're told that. When you eat, that's given to you. What you eat, where you're going to sleep, where you're going to hike, what the job is, where you're going to travel to. Your entire schedule is lined out for you minute by minute. And then when the off season comes, that all goes away. And a lot of folks kind of get disheveled and kind of let things go because they don't continue that structure in their life that made them the dialed individual that they were during the fire season. And things start to slip. And again, like Danny says, that complacency sets in. And that's when people start to really struggle. Goodson also found a sense of community in that ultra world. She explains that although she felt like an outsider at first, everyone she met was very supportive and offered advice and moral support along the way. It was cool to get into it like a tourist and realize, wow, these people are all super supportive and everybody is really having a good time. That's one of the things I also love about hotshotting. Things can really suck, but everyone is still having a good time with it. It goes back to that old saying, embrace the suck. Or when you're having a hard time on a PT hike or you're trying to get up to this ridge and you got 50 pounds on your back and it's just the worst thing ever and you're struggling, you realize that 23 people around you are having a really shitty time as well. And it builds that camaraderie and it allows you to realize, oh, this is a team. Yes, it sucks for everybody, but we're all doing it together. The article concludes saying it's no secret the planet is heating up this year and it's at the forefront of conversations and discussions, both in Congress and the local breweries. With the future at stake, many people are looking at ways to become more involved with the solution, whether that's climate activism, fire ecology, or staring the beast right in the eyes and training to become a wildland firefighter. Distance running has increasingly become the shoe that fits for those who decide to swing tools and arm themselves with chainsaws to combat increasing wildfires. As each fire season becomes hotter and drier, you may also see an uptick in hotshots at your next race. Be sure to give them a fist bump and thank them because being a hotshot is often a selfless and at times an unappreciated gig. Yeah, almost exclusively that way. I thought I'd share that. It's a great article and it talks about three dialed in, super fit individuals who have been working on hotshot crews and have taken it into this endurance athlete realm. Again, I can't stress enough how important it is to find that community outside of your hotshot crew, outside of the jump base, outside of wildland firefighting when that season comes to a conclusion, because that's how people slip into that depression and slip into these dark places where, you know, they start drinking, they start doing drugs, they start making really poor decisions. And then, of course, that spirals. And if they want to get back into firefighting the next season, they're just playing catch up. And as we all know, these things can play a role in, you know, causing real problems in relationships, in your home life, with your family. And it's really important and why I stress myself, get fit and stay fit. Work to have goals, meet those goals and set new ones. If you are going to challenge yourself to be on a hotshot crew, take that into your personal life and find hobbies where ultimately it gives you an advantage over others and you can be successful in other realms while using the skills that you've developed while you've been wildland firefighting. Shout out to everybody that was interviewed in that article. I think it's a good lesson and I think it's great for the general population to kind of get that view in, which is what I've been striving to do here for the last few years, is to try to educate the public on what it's actually like, what folks go through, how undersupported and underappreciated this work is, and bring awareness to these communities. Because folks who are in these communities, jumpers, hotshots, all the rest, know it's not talked about a lot. It's taboo to talk to the media. and the story doesn't really get out there. And it's hard to gain public and congressional support if you don't talk about it and it basically stays in the shadows. Ultimately, people don't know you exist, and why would they want to provide funding and help and support if they don't even know you're out there? I was talking to the CEO of Dauntless Air. Shout out, longtime supporter, great guy, great company. I can't stress enough how important their support was early on. Just by providing encouraging words and saying, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We're listening and things are great. But after a conversation with him, he was saying the same thing. He's like, people don't know what you folks do out there. He's like, we're flying our tankers over you and we know you're down there, but even we don't have a full understanding of what it's like on the ground for 14 days straight, 16 hours a day. And, you know, he agreed with this needs to be brought to light because it's hard to get support for something that people don't realize is there. Real quick, before I close the show, I wanted to talk about Region 3. They popped a 20-acre fire. I believe it actually grew to like 58 acres yesterday. It was this noon fire down on the Coronado National Forest. A Type 4 team came in. After that fire popped, I had all sorts of people start messaging me saying, hey, Region 3 looks like it's going to pop off this spring. Dry fuels everywhere. We don't have a lot of moisture, which is a huge change from what it was last year. Last year, if you don't know, Region 3 was very, very slow. And that's the region that usually sucks up a lot of resources at the beginning of the fire season, and people kind of mobilize down to Arizona and New Mexico before the western United States, the Rockies, and other parts start to really pop off. Last year, it was cooler, and they had a ton of moisture down in those areas. But now it's, what, January 20th, and they popped this little fire. I'm not saying this is some big, huge thing, and everybody should be super worried, but the folks that are down there after this 50-some acre fire popped off basically were saying, hey, if we don't get that spring moisture, we're going to see a big, big fire season down here in Region 3. So I just wanted to get that across to folks as well. It could be an early run-and-gun type season. California has a ton of fuel on the ground after their record rain and snowfall last year. This goes same for Utah and Colorado. Up in Montana had a very rainy season last summer, as did most of the western United States. As I've written about on the Substack, it was the slowest fire season in nearly three decades, 2023. So what does that mean? Well, it means there's more fuel on the ground. There's more potential for fine fuels to grow if there is some spring rain with that dead layer underneath it, which ultimately will cause that live fine fuel to dry out faster. And we could see an early run and gun start. So I just wanted to get that out there. I'm obviously going to be watching Region 3 as we proceed into February and March, really in March for sure, to see if the rains come, to see if the temperatures come back up comparatively to last year where it was milder and rainier. And if those trends start to show their face, I would expect a lot of resources being funneled down to the Southwest region, Region 3, early on in preparation for that busy early fire season down there. Again, I'd like to thank all the paid Substack subscribers. Everything that I do is supported solely through the community. No ads, no sponsors, and I couldn't do any of this without you. Again, if you want to support what I do, it's the hotshotwakeup.substack.com. That link is below. Click on that subscribe button to support what I do. On that note, reach out to your homies you haven't talked to in a while. Maybe you and your friends are running ultras together and preparing for a 50K, 60K race. And even if that is the case, you should check up on them because that's not easy. That's hard work. They're still training. But at the same time, it still maintains that camaraderie that you've built throughout the summer. Get outside, get that fresh air, exercise, stretch, hydrate, eat those quality calories because those are the ones that count. Get the rest you need because you can't recover without that. But as always, when you get up, you got to get it done.